This is Mark Edwards, and we're doing a sort of a make-it-up-as-you-go Luther and the Renaissance, or maybe the Luther and the Reformation. Today is Renaissance Day. Does anyone know what Renaissance means? Rebirth. You know what the rebirth, what was being reborn?
Back then?
Mm-hmm.
And just come out of the Dark Ages.
Okay.
Rebirth of culture.
Rebirth of art. Culture, art,
and knowledge.
What?
Knowledge.
Knowledge. The notion of a Renaissance. This was a word that the Italians used to describe what they were doing in the from the late 14th century on. What happened was it's a rebirth of classical learning, specifically Latin studies. Although it had a number of other characteristics. And it was, in fact, a man named Petrarch, who was the one that came along and talked about the time in which he lived as being a dark age. Nowadays, when we talk about the dark ages, we normally have the period from, maybe 700 to 1,000. That's the period that's normally called the dark ages. And then the middle ages, the middle period, runs up somewhere into the 15th century, depending on where you are. But the Renaissance begins in Italy, and it begins with people like Petrarch, another fellow you may know, Boccaccio. Oh, did a camera. In the 14th century, but it really takes off in the 15th century in Italy. And what I'm going to do today is tell you a little bit about the Renaissance, and then tie it into Martin Luther and tell you a little bit about Luther, and then I'm going to try to leave some time for you just to ask questions about the Renaissance or the Reformation. I am trained as what's called a Renaissance Reformation scholar. That's actually when I was trained at Stanford, was in these two fields. I subsequently, sort of a historian of Christianity, I've taught from the intertestamental period before the birth of Christ all the way up to the 20th century. But at Harvard, I was mainly teaching from the 5th century through the 20th century with an emphasis on the Reformation. My work has been on Martin Luther. And so what I'm going to do, having taught all that, I can do a whole course on the Renaissance, which I will not do for you today. And have frequently done whole courses on the Renaissance and whole courses not only on the Reformation but just on Martin Luther. Instead, what I want to do today is sort of share some things with you. And to set the stage, I'd like you to picture a room. The room would be not much, probably a ceiling lower than this, maybe twice the size of this room, or a little bit more. It is 4 in the evening in April, 1521, and it's already become fairly dark outside, and so there are torches around the walls. You got this in your mind's eye? You might shut your eyes and sort of think about this room with the torches. And down at one end of the room, there's this raised dais on which there is a chair, and a young, looks like a 21-year-old fellow is sitting on there with a crown and all the robes. He's surrounded by nobles wearing their finest furs and the like. There's actually a couple Native Americans among the group there. Most of them are speaking Spanish, some are speaking French. He himself speaks French. And then along the walls, sides of this, are all of the German nobility and representatives of imperial cities wearing their furs and, you know, depending on what rank there was, you were allowed to wear certain furs. And if you were of a higher rank, you got ones that lower ranks couldn't wear. So you could actually look around and tell who's what by what they're wearing. And then in the center of this room is a table on which are piled about 20 pamphlets, little booklets, not hardcover, piled up. And it was into this room, there's led a fairly young man in his early 30s, neatly tonsured. That is, you know, I'm naturally tonsured. This person is neatly tonsured, wearing the simple habit of an Augustinian friar. And the imperial spokesman comes forward and says, Yesterday, you had an opportunity to answer the question whether these books were yours and whether you're willing to recant, and you asked for 24 hours to think it over. The 24 hours are up. What's your answer? So the monk, who is of course Martin Luther, who is also a professor, tries to give a long, complicated answer. This is what professors do. Well, on the one hand, there's this group. And the finally, the imperial spokesman says, no, wait a minute. I want an answer without any quibbling. Are these your books, and are you willing to recant what you teach them? And so Luther drew himself up and said, I cannot and I will not recant. My conscience is captive to the word of God, unless I'm convinced by scripture, by evident reason. Because I do not trust in popes or emperors, because they have often contradicted themselves. My conscience captive to the word of God, here I stand. He didn't say, here I stand. That was the press that said that later on. He just said, may God help me. A couple more exchanges, and then he was led from the room. And as he was going out, the Spaniards, who knew what to do with heretics, yelled, to the fire with him, to the fire with him. And he, for his part, put his hand over his head like this, the sign of a victorious gladiator. He probably would use a different hand gesture today. And said, I'm through. So really dramatic. It's the dramatic appearance of Martin Luther appearing at the Diet of Worms. And what was leading up to that appearance, where he made his famous statement that unless he was convinced by scripture and evidence reasons, his conscience was captive to the word of God. Leading up to that had also been dramatic. He'd started out at this little university town in central Germany. It's 200 students at the university, little university of Wittenberg. It was not even 20 years old, or just barely 20 years old at that point. And he had traveled south down to the city of Worms to meet the imperial parliament, or Diet of Worms. And along the way, at every little town and city along the way, he was escorted in and was feted by the city council. And Latin speeches were made by the local humanists, welcoming him, calling him here a hero. And when he reached Worms, going into Worms, the people lining the streets, and we have the report from the papal legate, that is the pope's representative, saying that among these people, 9 out of every 10 person was yelling, long live Luther. And the 10th, in case the pope might have thought at least 1 out of 10, the 10th was yelling, death to the pope. So, and then, you know, so it had this triumphal entrance, and then finally this presented with his writings, this pile of works, the product of the recently invented printing press, and he says he will not recant. On his way home, having left Worms, he's kidnapped. Later, it turns out it's by people that his prince had sent set up to do it, and he's spirited off to the Wartburg, where he will spend the next little over a year getting fatter, becoming constipated, and translating the New Testament from Greek into German. This picture of Martin Luther has in it all the elements that help us to understand what the Reformation is all about. And let me go through some of these, and then I'll tie them into the Renaissance. Let's start with that triumphal procession from the little University of Wittenberg. Wittenberg means sand hill. And have any of you visited Wittenberg? Yeah, it's not a very prepossessing place. It's sort of the end of nowhere. This brand new struggling university, in order to sort of make its mark, had adopted the latest intellectual fashions, and that is humanism, which I'll be talking to you in a bit, because it's part of the Renaissance legacy. It was under the protection of the Elector of Saxony. He was called the Elector because he was one of 7 people who together could elect the emperor. And he was very jealous of his new university and was not happy when his sort of star professor began to be attacked by the Dominican friars from other places. And since he was one of the electors, he was able to hold out and insist that Luther have a hearing. before the imperial diet, before he could be condemned. So that's one element. The traveling through it, each of these cities and towns along the way where Luther was put up and speeches were made and he was welcomed, the intellectuals who were acting as the city secretaries and some of the patricians who were his early supporters and who had spread his writings around and who had urged their rulers to support Martin Luther, these people were all part of the humanistic movement, which is tied to the Renaissance. And I'll explain more of it about this in a minute. His entrance into Worms, where people, 9 out of 10, were yelling "Long live Luther," and the 10th was yelling "Death to the Pope," indicates the very popular nature of the movement in its early phases. It also illustrates the great hostility that many of the people held for Rome and for the Pope. There was a common belief that the Pope was bleeding the poor dumb Germans dry and taking money from them down in order to support a lavish and unseemly lifestyle. The indulgences, which had been the issue on which Luther first came to public attention, the indulgences had been promulgated. You know, an indulgence is normally a cash payment in order to substitute this gift of a cash payment for the satisfaction that one owed after one had been absolved by a priest. But there were many who felt that this indulgence was just a trick to part the Germans from their money. Certainly may. Bring them back, though.
Yeah.
Wait here a second. Recollect my thought.
Indulgences.
Yeah, indulgences. And as it was, as it actually happened, half of all the proceeds for the St. Peter's indulgence were flowing south to help build St. Peter's in Rome. The other half was going to pay off the debt incurred by a cardinal, well, it wasn't a cardinal yet, but Albrecht of Mainz, who was holding 3 bishoprics simultaneously, which was against canon law, and while underage. So he had to pay a very large sum of money for dispensation to allow him to do this. If you look in the diet of the room itself with the torches and all the people, there are other important factors that entered into the Reformation. One, of course, was that young man in his early 20s seated on the throne. This was Charles V, elected Holy Roman Emperor. But he also was Charles I of Spain. He was the ruler over the ancestral Habsburg lands of Austria and Hungary and the like. He also was the Duke of Burgundy. He controlled large sections of Italy and even of North Africa. He controlled at least, or united in his person, the largest expanse of land that any ruler had ruled since Charlemagne, way back in the 9th century. He had been elected. He had all of these territories. And he was a staunch Catholic, but whenever he tried to do something about Martin Luther and the Reformation, his dynastic concerns got in the way. Because remember, he controlled Austria and Hungary. Well, the Turks were pushing against, the Islamic Turk were pushing against the eastern borders of the empire, and every so often he had to mount armies, and many needed the support of the Protestants in order to turn away the Turk. And as soon as he got the Turks under control, the French, which he surrounded on all sides, would rise up, and there would be another, what was called Habsburg-Valois War. The French ruling family were the Valois, and Charles was a member of the Habsburg family. You've probably seen pictures of the Habsburgs. They have this terrible problem with their lower jaw. So there's the Habsburg chin, very prominent in pictures. He wanted to stamp out the Reformation, but by the time he finally got around to it, some 20 years later, over 20 years later, Protestantism had sunk in too deeply to be eradicated. There are also all of the representatives that surrounded Charles. These were the, along with the 7 electors, these were the various rulers of the Holy Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Empire was a mess in terms of governance. There were somewhere between 200 and 300 independent or semi-independent entities within that empire, plus a couple thousand counties that were run by imperial knights, or little, excuse me, not counties, but little areas run by imperial knights. And so one of the ways that the Reformation spread in this hodgepodge of different principalities and bishoprics and abbacies and what have you, was that if the local rulers sort of cracked down on the Reformation, they could go a couple miles into another area and set up shop again. So that was another important factor. But probably the most important factor was what you found there on that table, the 20 to 30 titles that had come out of the press under Luther's name in just a few years. Martin Luther was an extraordinarily gifted author in the German language, one of the greatest German writers of all time. He also came at a point when the printing press was relatively new. It had been invented perhaps 70 years earlier. And for the first 50 or 60 years, largely been used by the church in various, to do the equivalent of hymnals and the like. But Martin Luther came along and was able to use the press in a way that, well, there had been some antecedents that really had never been used the way Luther did to mobilize a mass movement. During his lifetime, he died in 1546, his publications alone made up 20% of everything that was printed in that pamphlet format in German. Can you believe that? 20%. You talk about a best-selling author.
Just in Germany? Yes. You're talking about overall
in Germany? Oh, in the German-speaking areas. 20%. And he was only one author. There were a whole bunch of other Protestants who turned to the press and put out these little pamphlets, mainly, often decorated with polemical woodcuts. They were small. You could put them in your cloak when the authorities came by. They were often written in such a way that they were useful not only to the literate, but the illiterate as well. So they were put into rhyme. Their titles were often easy to remember. They had instructions, read these aloud to your friends. They were away in a country where probably 95% of the population was illiterate, to get the word out even to the illiterate. And it was the printing press allowed what could have been just a local affair to become national and ultimately international. But it was what was in those writings that was most important of all. And it was in those writings that Martin Luther laid out his understanding of Christianity. And in the process, in what he said positively and what he attacked in the Roman Church, he somewhat unintentionally created a new branch of Christianity known as evangelical, or the evangelical wing. That's why the Lutheran Church calls itself still the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. The word evangelical has been largely captured by other groups within our society, but Luther and his supporters called themselves evangelisch. And they saw themselves as spreading the good news of the gospel. So that's sort of a setup. What I'd like to do now is step back, first ask if there are any questions, and then step back and say a little bit about what was in those books and how it was related to the Renaissance. But first, questions.
So you're saying that it was like the basic reader for the illiterate? People could read at that point, but you said they were set up so that...
They were set up so that people could read them to others. They used a variety of styles. A significant number were rhyming, so you could say it out. People could learn it by memory, by heart. They were often illustrated, so you could look at the picture and figure out from the picture what's the point.
So it did really reach down to the servant girl level?
In some cases, but any movement like this probably touches only a minority of the population.
Did you say he was carrying them and hiding them?
I'd say that
the readers,
the little pamphlets were, you know, they were about half the size of something like this. They might be 16 pages or 8 pages, and they were small enough that you could put them in a pack. They could circulate very easily. They were relatively inexpensive to buy. And that you could hide them away, you know, if people came to to check them out.
But they have potent messages.
They have very potent messages. Probably in the cities, maybe 30% of the population could read who lived in the cities. Now,
so that's like merchants?
Well, no, that'd be merchants, artisans, you know, shoemakers, candle makers, tanners, as well as merchants. But cities in this period, the largest city in the Holy Roman Empire was only 50,000. That wouldn't even be an incorporated suburb in a lot of places today. And so if 30% could read in the cities out in the countryside where most people lived, it was probably 5%. But what happened was the people who could read would then often share the message orally. They'd preach it from the pulpit. A lot of the Reformation spread by preachers. In fact, that was probably the vehicle by which it most broadly spread. But it was also discussed in alehouses, and there, a little later we have evidence of the Protestants sending out people to write graffiti on the walls. And they composed songs that were sung, Luther himself wrote hymns and others wrote hymns, and that if you look at any of Luther's hymns, you pick up something like the Green Book and look at some of Luther's hymns, you'll find they're very theological. If you go through all 10 verses of some of them, you've learned a lot of theology. We don't sing most of them today because they seem too didactic. But they also wrote little ditties and what have you, attacking each other. So they used every means at their disposal to get the word out. Okay, let's talk a bit about what was in the books. Martin Luther had grown up within a society which had certain understandings about the way in which one was made right with God. Now, are you right with God? Have you heard that expression today? Yeah. Well, it's the word justification. It is literally that. Making right. Remember Petrarch here that I talked about, who lived in the 14th century in Italy? Petrarch tells the story of climbing a mountain in southern France named Mount Ventoux. And in this story, he and his brother decided to climb the mountain. His brother, he was like a jackrabbit, goes right up the hill. Whereas Petrarch, you know, easily tired out, takes the switchbacks along the way, and you know, rests and looks at the view, and finally gets up to the summit. In the 19th century, people reading this were convinced this was a sign of the Renaissance. It's the first discovery of nature. He's the first modern sightseer. Turns out, actually, this story of the ascent of Mount Ventoux was an allegory. It was an allegory about how a human being became right with God. His brother happened to be a Carthusian monk. And that meant he was leading a life of self-denial and ascetic self-denial and prayer and service to others and poverty, chastity, obedience. That was seen to be more pleasing to God. And so, in a way, he became acceptable to God much more rapidly than Petrarch, who was more of a lay person literary figure who, you know, was stuck in all these switchbacks and going back and forth. It took a lot longer to reach God. The difference between the two is an illustration of a general understanding in the period before Luther of how a person was saved. Let me, at the risk of caricaturing some serious positions, let me explain a little how it worked. Theologians in the medieval period, and there are different schools of thought, and there will be many nuances in this, but basically they thought in order to approach God, in order to become right with God, you had to become like God. Had to become like God. God was love, so you had to become loving yourself. Or, as you became loving, you also became lovable. God would be willing to accept you into God's sight. And so life, becoming right with God, was a process by which one gradually, gradually became more and more like God, more and more loving. Now, from the time of Augustine in the 5th century on, it was generally understood in the Western Church that you could not become like God, you could not become fully justified without God's assistance. But once God assisted you, you were supposed to cooperate with God's, the gift of God's grace, and gradually become more and more loving. And to sort of make a long story short, I'll draw you a picture. Let's say, any of you physics majors there? Let's say this is a thing, and this is time going in this direction. And this is how much grace you have. That is, how loving are you? Going up this way. This is positive. This is negative. The grace that you received was the capacity to love. It was thought that once God started you on your way, God would give you the ability to love others selflessly. A little bit of an ability. If you use that divine gift, that capacity to love, if you used it as God intended, God would reward you with a greater capacity. And if you use that well, God would reward that use with even greater capacity. And eventually, you would be transformed by this capacity to love selflessly. And that upon your death, if you had been completely transformed, you could enter into God's sight. So in a way, if you might say that if that's a chart, let's say this is how much grace you have to enter into heaven. Okay? So much capacity to love. You start out, you're baptized, and you use the capacity to love. God rewards you with more capacity, and you're going up like this. Now, if you're someone like Boccaccio's brother, who's the Cartusian monk, you rarely falter, and you sort of race to the top. If you die right at this point, what happens to you? You go to heaven. And you're a saint, if you've done that in this lifetime. Most people, like Petrarch, you would go through life like this. Then they would do something wrong, and they're down here. What happens if you're down here? You go to hell. You've gone out on your prom. You did something you're not supposed to do. You're down here. You run into a tree at that point. You're in serious trouble. But let's say you go to the sacrament of penance or confession, and you start over again. And let's say you run into the tree now. What happens to you? Purgatory. You go to purgatory because you've got to make up this difference here. What about Petrarch's brother who was up here? What, you know, Petrarch's brother doesn't need all of this. What happens to this excess capacity?
Pass it on now.
Treasury of merits. It goes into the treasury of merits to fund indulgences. So Martin Luther came along, and based on his reading, especially of Paul and the Gospel of John, but then that in turn opened up all of scriptures to him, he became convinced that this understanding of how one was made right with God was wrong, fatally wrong. And that in fact, one was made right with God not by anything that you could do, with or without God's assistance. It had nothing to do with what happened inside of you. Rather, it was entirely dependent on what Christ, or God through Christ, had done for you. That is the death on the cross. And if you could appropriate that death by faith, and faith itself was a gift of God, it was not something, it was not a psychological good work that you could do. If you believe that God, if you trusted God's promise that Christ had died for you, you were thereby saved. You were thereby made right with God. And so that no longer was there a notion of progress.
You either had it or you didn't. Now, it's true. Once that you had faith and you trusted, there still could be growth, spiritual growth, what was called sanctification. The gift of faith brought with it the gift of Christ, and you would struggle to become a better person. But your salvation had nothing to do with what you did. It had only to do with what Christ had done for you, and that your good works that followed were the what was called the fruit of faith. Now, in a normal lecture, I would explain, spend a lot of time laying this out of what its implications were for society. But because we're talking about the Renaissance today, I want to back up and tie all this into what was happening in the Renaissance. But first, any questions?
Well, this whole concept really threatens the financial structure of the church.
Oh, yeah. With this change, for example, the gradations of society are changed because there's no longer a monk or a nun or a priest was given a different legal status than a layperson because they were thought to be living a life more pleasing to God. It was thought that what they were doing benefited the larger community. With this new understanding where everyone is dependent on Christ, then there can't be a special class of people. And so the city of Worms, which was 10% clergy when Luther made his entrance, a few years later was less than 1%. And that's a big social change right there. Mm. The pilgrimage sites, the relic collections and all, in Protestant areas disappeared. The state took over the control of the church. Another big change. So this new theological understanding had tremendous social and political repercussions. Let's back up now and talk about the Renaissance. As I say, this is a bit of a caricature. The theologians, there's a lot of nuance here, and it's not as crass in some ways as it would seem, although you could encounter people that would lay it out just about this crassly in the 15th and 16th century. The Renaissance begins in Italy. And there are historians, debate on why it is that happens. Italy was still pretty urban, much more urban than most of Europe in the 14th and the 15th century. And the Renaissance in its literary and intellectual form arises among the ruling groups in these urban areas, both the secretaries to the city and to some of the patricians who serve on the ruling bodies. You could never say that a city like Florence was democratic, but it also wasn't. It had a much wider franchise, as it were, than you would find in most places at that time. Several hundred male individuals, males, members of the prominent families, were involved in governing. And in this group, beginning in the 14th century, there was an increasing interest in the classical world. Now, in the medieval period, people still read some of the classics. But there was a change in the Renaissance and how these were approached and understood. And what developed was something that in the university was called the studia humanitatis. That's the study of the humanities. So when we talk about Renaissance humanism, we have to be careful not to confuse it with something like secular humanism in the 20th century. The humanism in that period was the study of the humanities that was developed in the universities but had an analog in these patrician areas in the city. And what they were interested in is they were going back all the way to the original classical sources. So the sort of the watchword is ad fontes, back to the sources. And they were interested in certain things about the classical period. They were interested in grammar and rhetoric. Grammar, this would be Latin grammar initially, and then Greek later on. Rhetoric, that is the art of persuasive speech, and poetics. This would be Latin poetics. They were interested in history, classical history above all, and actually the beginnings of the modern notion, modern historical understanding, finds its roots in this period.
If you look at the art of the Renaissance and look at and compare it with some of the art, what is called medieval art of the same period, you'll notice some very big differences. Not just perspective and that like, but if you look at the costumes, any of you can help us out? What's the big difference between the costumes of someone like Michelangelo? I mean, what people are wearing in his paintings when he's painting classical scenes, and say what you'd find in medieval paintings.
Like kind of togas.
What? Togas?
Well, toga is Roman,
yeah.
But Greek is sort of light sheath over the climate.
Right. What you find is, what Bonnie is alluding to here, is that you find that he's attempting to put them in garb that they would have actually worn in the classical period. Whereas you look at the medieval paintings, and they are they're depicted as if they were contemporaries of the artist.
Clearly, the realist, working with light and dark.
That's right. There's the realism. There's the perspective. There's the plasticity of it. But just the costume indicates a new historic awareness that actually. Life was different 1,000 years earlier than it was now. So there was the beginnings of a sense of historic distance. Moral philosophy, the word moral here is very important, and it ties into rhetoric, because these humanists, many of whom were politicians, I use that word with quotes around it, or involved in government service, were very interested in getting people to do what they were supposed to do. And so if they had to make a choice, they would much prefer, by using rhetoric to encourage people to do the right thing, than to use logic and philosophy and, you know, rational arguments to make people do it. In the trade-off between, knowing the truth and doing what's right, they would choose doing what's right. They had a very action-oriented view of the world. And a number of these folks trained in this area made important discoveries based on their interest in the classical languages and their interest in moral philosophy and their awareness of history. So, for example, there's a man named Lorenzo Valla, who lived in the middle of the 15th century. Here, by the way, is sort of giving you a timeline. Lorenzo Valla was a papal secretary, among other things. But despite who his employer was during part of his career, he used his growing understanding of history and the way in which language changes to take a very famous document called the Donation of Constantine. I'll tell you what this is in a minute. And to show that it was a forgery. The Donation of Constantine purported to be a letter written by the original Christian emperor, Constantine, back in the 4th century. In it he says he had leprosy and he was cured by the Pope at Rome, and therefore he gave control over the western half of the empire to the Pope. And the papacy was using this as one of the arguments for why it should have authority over all of Western Europe, because the original emperor had given the Pope this authority. Now, the Pope was not resting his claims to authority solely on the Donation of Constantine, but that was an important weapon in his arsenal in disputes over what sort of control he had had. Well, Lorenzo Valla, who had studied the language very well, realized that language itself has a history, that words and their meaning change over time. New words come into being. He was able to show that a number of the words in the donation could not possibly have been used by Constantine because they first were invented in the 8th and 9th century. Now, you and I are, you know, we smile and think, boy, he's got him. This was a whole new way of thinking at this time, and this didn't convince a lot of folks, but it certainly convinced Lorenzo and other humanists that
this donation was a forgery. Martin Luther later found out about this and had this, his, the piece that Lorenzo Valla wrote, he had it republished in German translation. It's up there, stick it to the Pope again. So Renaissance humanism, as opposed to Renaissance art, was going back to the sources, was interested in the original languages, had a respect for history that was not common leading up to that point. And all of these things play into the Reformation. To begin with, Martin Luther himself was a scholastic theologian. He was trained in one branch of scholasticism, which was the medieval approach to theology. But early in his career as a professor, he came under the influence of a variety of different folks, especially a young humanist by the name of Melanchthon, who arrived in Wittenberg about a year after the indulgence controversy was launched to teach Greek. He was a humanist, very much interested in languages and the like. And Martin Luther immediately started learning Greek from Melanchthon. And of course, in 1522, when Luther translated the New Testament into German, he used not only the Vulgate or Latin version of the Bible, which he knew by heart, but he also used another humanist by the name of Erasmus. Erasmus in 1516 had created a Greek version of the New Testament with his own Latin translation. And as that one was reprinted in 1518, and Luther took that 1518 version with him to the Wartburg. So Luther was strongly influenced by this, by the Renaissance interest in languages, and himself became a passable Greek scholar, even learned Hebrew later, which the humanists were also interested in. And although it took him only a few months to translate the Bible from Greek and Latin into German, it took him 12 years to do the Old Testament. And for the Old Testament and the subsequent revisions of the New Testament, he collected what he called his Sanhedrin, a group of humanist scholars, humanistically trained scholars, who helped him understand the original languages and do a faithful translation. On Saturday, when I talk about Luther and the Bible, I will lay out many ways in which he was faithful to Luther's theological understanding of the Bible as opposed to perhaps the original Greek. So one of the ways in which Luther borrowed heavily from humanism and the Renaissance was through the languages. Another that Luther borrowed from was this view of history. In the very early stages of the Reformation, it started over indulgences, where in a neighboring territory, the St. Peter's indulgence was being preached. And Luther's own parishioners, who was acting as the town pastor as well as a professor, were crossing the border and buying these indulgences and then coming back and saying his parishioner was saying they didn't have to confess to him, because one of the parts of the St. Peter indulgence says they could choose their own confessor. And Luther, who was a fairly strict confessor, you know, was not their first choice, he got more than a bit annoyed. Not just annoyed, really worried about their souls. And so the 95 Theses on Indulgences was an invitation to debate the validity of indulgences. But indulgences very quickly were foreshadowed by the question of the authority of the Pope. Because as it turned out, the argument for indulgence was not a very strong one, and even the Catholic supporters quickly realized that they didn't have a good case on historic or other grounds for indulgences. Indulgences had only been around for a couple hundred years. And indulgences for the dead in purgatory were years old. In fact, they were more like 70 years old, with the notion of a treasury of merit and all that. And so, as good debaters, they changed the debate. They moved it from indulgences to the power of the Pope to issue indulgences.
And so Luther was pushed from discussing indulgence to discussing what authority the Pope actually had. And in the course then of preparing for a very famous, at least famous to Luther scholars, debate in 1519 at Leipzig against a man named Johann Eck, Luther did a lot of reading in history. And it was in the course of his reading, as he said in a letter to his friend Spalatin, that he began to suspect that maybe the Pope was the Antichrist because he had perverted the church in so many significant ways. So his historical study both helped him along in his own thinking of what was going on, and then he used his reading of history in his writings against the Pope and to support his view of Christianity. So that's another way in which the Renaissance was very important to Martin Luther. But the most important way in which the Renaissance and humanism supported the Reformation was in the people who ended up being the first pastors and the first supporters of Luther's new understanding of Christianity. Martin Luther was in his mid-30s when the Reformation started. That was pretty old for that period. But most of the people who took up the banner and had his treatises reprinted in their own town and wrote treatises themselves in support of Martin Luther and began preaching from pulpits were young people in their teens and their 20s. People don't realize the Reformation was largely run by people in their early 20s, the major leaders, people like Melanchthon and Bucer, Ecolampadius, Zwingli. All of these folks tended to be younger. Zwingli wasn't, but younger people. And they were, if not to a man, at least to a very large extent, all trained in humanism. So in those crucial two or three years, from 1518 to, say, 1523-24, the Reformation spread mainly by and through humanists. People around the empire who had gone back and studied the classics, had become interested in the Christian classics, which would be not only the Bible, but also the early church fathers, both Greek and Latin fathers. It was these people who were the ones who were the early advocates for the Reformation. And it was many of these who became the first pastors who, in the towns above all, preached the evangelical understanding of Christianity to the population. And so you could really say that without the Renaissance, there would have been no Reformation. Because, I mean, we don't know this. Counter the fact there was a Renaissance, there was a Reformation. But let's say that without the Renaissance, it's hard to imagine the Reformation taking the shape that it did. Questions?
Back to Luther as confessor. This is new to me. Would the confessor do a little chastising? A little,
oh, yeah.
Okay, I didn't have that picture.
Luther, well, this was before his Reformation. The confessor would, there's four parts to the sacrament of penance. And the first is you've got to be sorry for the sins you committed. Then there's confession to a priest. And then absolution by the priest. And then an imposition of satisfaction or activities you'll do to show that you're sorry and to sort of undo the harm that you've done. So those are the four parts. And Luther acted as a confessor where he heard the confession and made sure that the people were truly sorry for the sins they committed. And then he opposed penance or works of satisfaction on the people. And of course, he also confessed himself. And that some of his concerns about the adequacy of his own confession were at the bottom of his wrestlings with Paul and other parts of the scripture that ultimately led to the Reformation breakthrough.
How soon after the invention of the printing press in Germany did the Pope get access to the printing press, or did he have enough scribes that he didn't need a printing press?
Well, the printing press came to Italy quite early, too. Although it was, I can't remember the date, but a printing press being established in Rome, probably around 1480. It's a little bit later than some other places. But in the war of published words in Germany, Martin Luther alone, his publications alone, outnumbered all the publications of all the Catholic authors. And he was only one author. The Protestants just devastated the Catholics in publications. It wasn't until about 40 years later that the Catholics learned to use the printing press effectively, and that was thanks to the Jesuits.
So there were, at that point, lots of writers anxious to be published. And the printing was not controlled by the church, it was a private enterprise?
It was a private enterprise. It was sort of the cutting edge of technology at the day. It was a very capital intense, because you had to spend a lot of money to buy the press and the type and the paper. Paper was very expensive. And it was before copyright, and so most of the reason Luther was such a best-selling author is he would publish a treatise in one place, normally Wittenberg, and then it would be pirated or reprinted all over the empire by other people who would not have to pay royalties to Luther. He was such a popular author early in this that printers in Augsburg, which was the major printing center, sent people up to Wittenberg just to take down Luther's sermons and send them back. On at least two occasions, Luther's writings were stolen from his writing desk and sent off to a printer, and then he got very angry about that. But although he was annoyed with the pirating, and especially with the Bible, he thought they made lots of mistakes and the like, and they were cheating the Wittenberg printers of their rightful income. On the other hand, he realized that without the printing press, he couldn't have gotten the message out the way that he did. It was easier for the Protestants in some ways to use the press than for the Catholics. For one thing, I have written a whole book on this that came out in 94.
What's it called?
Printing Propaganda and Martin Luther. Until the evangelicals had their own church to defend, it was much easier to attack the Catholics, because they were a real institution with all the failings that were involved. It was only as Lutheran churches developed and other churches that the Catholics had a nice convenient target to attack back. There are a number of other differences, but the Protestants used the press far more effectively than the Catholics.
The Vatican was really the source of the humanistic transfer, wasn't it? I mean, they were the people doing the copying and presenting it, were they?
No, not really. There was some humanism in Rome, but not very much. The real centers were in Florence and Venice. And in many ways, the Pope lagged behind in the humanistic movement as well. Now, they did act as supporters of some of the famous painters. And there were some popes who were, Pius II was a humanist himself. Gnaeus Silvius Piccolomini. But as a generally speaking, the Rome and the papacy were lagged way behind this cultural development.
Were the young preachers that you mentioned that spread the Reformation, have any of them been priests?
Some of them were. Some of them had been monks. Many were lay people. As a general rule, in the first generation, most of the Reformation pastors were former Catholic priests.
Was the Black Death too late to have much effect on the Renaissance?
Or? Black Death is sort of the end of the medieval period in Italy. The Black Death arrives in Italy, in southern Italy, in 1347. 1348, it's
going through most of Europe, and by 1351, it's gotten all the way to Iceland. And about a third of the population was killed. And there's one school of thought that says that the Renaissance, this sort of all these new ideas, were in part made possible by the decimation of nobles and various ruling families in the Italian cities, whose positions then were filled by people from the countryside who were not as loyal, as it were, to the old tradition. I mean, historians argue about that, but the Black Death is more closely approximates the end of the medieval period. Now, Boccaccio's Decameron, any of you have read Boccaccio's Decameron or even know about it? One of the great pieces of literature. It's also fairly salacious. So it's the Tamron. It's ten sets of ten tales, and they're told by a group of ten folks who've gone out to a villa to escape the Black Death. And so they're telling the tales, and Chaucer picks up from Boccaccio many of the tales. So Chaucer's borrows from Boccaccio.
One of the characteristics of the Renaissance you've hinted at is the patronage of the arts. Isn't it true that Luther had a patron in Elector Frederick the Wise? To what extent were professors of universities and intellectual leaders dependent on wealthy support so that they could do what they did?
Well, someone like Erasmus, who was the greatest northern humanist, was heavily dependent upon patronage, or gifts from noble patrons. Luther himself received income as a professor, and then it was supplemented by the direct gifts from his prince. But largely the way the university was financed was following the medieval practice of sections of land that had an income were assigned to a particular person as a benefice, and then they would derive that income and that would support them in their position. Luther and Melanchthon received in addition additional salary directly from their prince, but mainly he was being paid.
Like when he was in Wartburg, didn't Elector Frederick kind of pay
for
that?
He supported, yeah, that's right. Oh, I mean, Luther could not possibly have survived without the support of his prince.
Maybe this is just a little bit off the topic, but where does the concept of celibacy fall with Luther being married and the other priests that night?
Well,
how was that played within this context?
We talked about sex yesterday. Celibacy. No, that's all right. It's the Council of Celibacy is rooted in the New Testament, where Paul and Jesus both are seen as saying that celibacy is superior in some ways to the married state. Luther came along and said that yes, it's true that celibacy is superior to the married state, but vowing to be celibate in order to please God, that is Petrarch's brother, was a complete misuse and attempting of God and a form of works righteousness, and condemned that. Then he went on to say that celibacy is a gift, and very few people get it. And as Paul said, it's better to marry than burn with desire, so that for most people who did not have the gift of celibacy, they should marry. A number of people around Luther married first, most famous of which being his colleague Andreas Bodenstein from Karlstadt. Luther then in the middle of the Peasants' War, got married himself. He dealt with a group of nuns that had been spirited away. He was able to place most of them. Two were left. One of them, Katie von Bora, insisted that she wouldn't marry anyone else except Luther or Bugenhagen, who was the town pastor. So Luther, when he got married, he said that he got married to please his father and spite the Pope. Later on, I think they had a loving relationship, but that was at least what he announced originally. He did it at the point when he thought he was going to die any time, because the Peasants' War was raging, and he wasn't sure what was going to happen next.
How do you feel about the book on Luther, Here I Stand?
Roland Baden's book? It's a fine book. It's a lot of fun to read. It's kind of dated. There are large sections of it that
are out of date. They're not. The best general book right now, you know, for if you just want a fairly short introduction to Luther based on modern scholarship, is one by Jim Kittleson called Luther the Reformer. Jim is a professor at the at Ohio State. My books have all been on sections of Luther. I have done one adult Sunday school general overview of his life, but my other books have been on parts of Luther's life. I've more written to other Luther scholars than for the general public. Not that I don't like to write for the general public, but that's just what I did. That's how you get promotions.
To what extent did the conflict between Luther and Eck go?
Well, I mean, Luther fought their whole life. Eck died in 43, Luther in 46, so I think that's right. Eck was a thorn in Luther's side throughout Luther's lifetime. In 1541, when the emperor was trying for one last time at Regensburg to see if they could negotiate an agreement between the Protestants and the Catholics, Eck was the leader of the Catholic faction that said no. So Eck was there.
But Melanchthon and Luther were hand in hand?
Hand in hand the whole time, yeah. I mean, Luther realized that there were some aspects of Melanchthon that he didn't fully agree with, but Melanchthon always enjoyed his support.
How many of these contemporaries lived out their lives, natural lives? Or were they still burned?
Well, no, there were very few that were burned or executed, relatively speaking. Some died of disease and what have you prematurely. Most of them. There were some executions, but not very many.
Yeah, let me follow a little bit more on this patronage question, because I'm intrigued by where all of this ended up in the Peasants' War. Mm-hmm. Tell me if I'm wrong, but my impression is that Luther, being patronized by the wealthy, part of a Renaissance movement of art and culture and music and everything, was coming out of the university community and influencing the whole world. But then when it turned to a peasants' revolt, when it turned ugly and political, when it turned the poorest people took pitchforks in their hands and went on the streets, Luther turned against them.
Yep.
Luther, in a way, he couldn't identify with the poorest of the poor at that moment.
Well, Luther was never a social revolutionary. Yeah. He was a religious group. He was, in fact, fairly conservative socially. The peasants took some of his ideas, especially his idea of Christian freedom, and gave it a secular, this worldly shift. And Luther said that was wrong, and wrote them and said it was wrong. And they said no. And then Luther wrote this ferocious treatise saying the princes should have been against the robbing and murdering hordes of peasants. And the princes followed his advice. The trouble is, it's too easy to take sort of a Marxist view of it, and Engels did write a book taking just that point of view. The Reformation was always a movement. Well, there wasn't a middle class in the 16th century the way we think of it. But there was sort of a middling layer, and the Reformation took hold most among those. And Luther, and they were also conservative. They were not interested in revolution. But there was a form of revolution in the imperial cities. Almost every one of them had a strong Reformation movement, and many of them had the effect of a religious revolution from below. And Luther supported that. So it's a complicated thing with the peasants. Luther was—he was consistent in his teachings all the way along on that. It wasn't like he had supported them one way and then turned on them. But he had, from their perspective, a far too spiritual view of what was at issue here. And they thought that if you talk about the freedom of a Christian, which Luther did, freedom from serfdom was something that should go with it. I'd be glad to talk about some more. We are about 10 minutes beyond the ending point. I'm going to be doing more. Tomorrow is St. Francis. And then Saturday I'm doing two sessions, one in the morning on how Luther read the Bible, and one in the afternoon on the this summer's theme, Lutheran baptism. So,